And statistically, the data doesn't lie. Like Gabor Maté published a book where he said people pleasers are at a higher risk of cancer. Like the data he pulled from the years of research that have been done, like it doesn't lie. And it's like I was doing all this, creating all this achievement to not only please my mother, like, but also not get picked on and not yelled at and not, be told I was a piece of garbage, basically, that I wasn't smart enough, that I wasn't enough, that I wasn't a good person, that I wasn't all these things that I've been told all the time.
Hello and welcome to Beyond Diagnosis, a podcast to raise your awareness, decisions, and voice for alternative practices so you can take back control of your health. I'm Rita DeMichelle, your host, a mindset and empowerment coach, and the founder of the Onus platform. Join me each week so you can create the health of your dreams. Welcome to Beyond Diagnosis. And in today's episode, we'll be talking about how Casey found a deeper life purpose after cancer. Casey Kang Head is a three-time survivor of acute lymphoblastic leukemia and stroke. She is now a cancer coach, a yoga instructor, a nutritionist, and a Reiki healer, and the author of Finding Your Way Back to Heart Center, Cancer Treatment Ended, Now What? Casey, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. And I think these sort of stories where we share what we've gone through, especially someone who's gone through such an aggressive cancer three times and has survived, and then experienced a stroke. And I know that's no easy feat. My mother had a massive stroke. There's a lot to that. And yeah, I would really love, I think it's so important that people actually hear these stories so they can garner some insights and help of what you did. So some, you know, words are powerful. People learn from other people's words. So I would really love it if we could actually start with how did this all start for you?
It actually, yeah, no, that's a great question. It started about 10 years ago on February 14th, 2014. I went for a follow-up appointment thinking like I was anemic, or that I was about to get strep throat and I was nipping it in the butt, right? I was being proactive. Little did I know that the appointment that I had made during lunch to go back to work, I wouldn't be going back to work for a very long time.
Wow.
Yeah, so I went to an ENT, which is ear, nose, throat doctor, and for the follow-up. And he's going over all the things that are happening inside me. And he goes, I think you should see an internist. And I'm like, okay. So we walk over to the internist, which is like a building away. And we walk in. My husband just happened. I think he knew something was inherently wrong and I didn't, which is why he was there. And we went into we stepped into the office and the waiting room is full. And they were like, oh, here's your room right here. And we bypassed everyone. And that's when I knew, I'm like, uh-oh, this must be kind of serious. Like, we just skipped the line.
That's a big, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a huge hint. You think, uh-oh, I've got the express lane. This can't be.
Right. Right. But I still, again, didn't think it was as severe as what it was. And the internist is going over everything. He goes, well, I need blood work to really confirm what's going on. He goes, the fastest way to get results are through the ER, or to I can order it and then I'll get them on Monday. And he was like, I looked at him. I go, well, what would you do? He goes, probably go to the ER, not panicking, not anything, right? Like, just this is what I would do. So we went to the ER, and sure enough, like a couple hours later, they were like, this is what we think is wrong with you. They can't confirm it until they have a bone marrow biopsy, but they're like, we're 99.9% sure this is what you have, and gave us sheets of paper about acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And I was like, what? Like I was in a little bit of denial, I'm not gonna lie. Rightfully so. Like I just my brain couldn't grasp what was happening. I had four hemoglobins at the time, so they immediately started giving me blood infusions, and I got transferred downtown. I was hospitalized for 30 days, technically 28 days, and I started chemo before we got results back from the bone marrow biopsy because that they were that sure.
Wow, that's unusual. That doesn't normally happen.
No, that's how positive they were
Jeez,
and how aggressive it was.
how aggressive. And whilst you were going through this, were you given a reason why you developed this cancer? Or, I mean, they gave you the prognosis, or the diagnosis. They gave you the diagnosis. But there was there any, explanation of why suddenly you were okay one day, or maybe it does build, and then all of a sudden so aggressive?
No, they really didn't say why. They just kept talking about, oh, the 18-month protocol of chemotherapy is going to cure, get you to cure, like 97% successful, blah, blah, blah. Like all these statistics, and then basically like what you're going to be doing for the next 18 months straight. And everything's very laid out. So it's more, we were more like concerned with what is this going to take? Like, versus why did this happen? And it wasn't until later, in hindsight, I can see why it happened. Technically, I was diagnosed with a children's cancer, which is really rare to begin with at 31, and even rarer to be diagnosed at that age. Like, I think there's like globally about 1,000 people a year. And to survive it of acute lymphoblastic leukemia in my age range of a young adult.
And that's considered a child disease, a child cancer.
Technically, it's categorized as a childhood cancer.
So normally you develop it in childhood, not necessarily in your 30s. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Yes. So it was
And
extremely rare.
for this to happen, so something obviously went amiss. Well, why do you, can I ask, why do you think if you look back, say on your life or what you had been doing or experiences, stress, anything like that, why do you think maybe you got this disease and didn't get a different disease?
In total honesty, it was a matter of which one and when, not versus like if it was just a matter of time and which one. And I truly believe it's as a result and a byproduct of. I had a very traumatic childhood. After my parents divorced, I lived with my mother and my stepdad full time. Well, not full time, they shared custody, but I was there at their primary residence most of the time. And my stepdad's extremely abusive physically, mentally, and emotionally. And I lived like that for 10 years, which led to decisions in my 20s to exacerbate what was already going on, right? Like, I didn't stop the stress cycle. I just kept living in it and adding more to my plate.
Right.
And at some point, like anything, it's gonna break. The system breaks. And so I truly believe it was a byproduct of me living under 2 straight decades of stress and nothing but it. And I can't turn back time. I wouldn't change any of the decisions I made during my 20s, but it did exacerbate, I think, what I was already feeling to a certain degree. I lived like a lot of people checking boxes, but not really knowing why or who for what, not really for me, but well, you're supposed to do this and this and this. And I said, okay. And
Ah,
kept going.
so do you feel because you were, I've actually just been listening to a lot of podcasts around people pleasing and the stress that comes from people pleasing, and I definitely had an element of, and I'm happy to say had an element of people pleasing. And they say the incredible stress that comes from that. And when you say tick the boxes, check the boxes, you don't even know why. Do you feel that that may be, for a word, like a knee-jerk reaction to the stress? And if I did everything right and I ticked all the boxes, well, then I'd be safer at home when you're saying you were living with an abusive stepfather. Do you think there's a correlation?
Oh, I agree. And statistically, the data doesn't lie. Like, Gabor Mate published a book where he said people pleasers are at a higher risk of cancer. Like the data he pulled from the years of research that have been done, like it doesn't lie. And it's like I was doing all this, creating all this achievement to not only please my mother, like, but also not get picked on and not yelled at and not, be told I was a piece of garbage, basically, that I wasn't smart enough, that I wasn't enough, that I wasn't a good person, that I wasn't all these things that I was being told all the time.
Yeah, it's a really hard thing to process, and I hope we're not going too deep here, for you, that we're okay
Yeah,
with this.
I mean, it makes me emotional because now that I know what I know, it hurts even more that an adult human can do that to a child.
Absolutely. It is frightening the amount of adults that do it to children. It is horrific, what happens. And I guess when we come out, like you've come out of it, the other end, you are, I guess, a lot more resilient, a lot more knowledgeable, a lot more aware, that you'll never repeat those patterns. And I guess that's kind of brings me to my next sort of question to find out, especially for the viewers who are listening to this, like, why, I was going to ask you, why then? Why then? What was happening in your life? And what were the messages that you were receiving that weren't being heard? Like, with these,
Honestly,
please.
no, that is a great question. I think it was the first time in my life that I had all the boxes checked. I had a house, I had the husband, I had the job, the career, I had friends, I had, what would seem on the outside a great life, but I was white knuckling that life. And it was the first time that I actually stopped and breathed and was like, I think I'm okay. And like I think my nervous system was just like, well, we can finally deal with the one thing you haven't been dealing with
Yeah.
that you need to deal with.
Can you speak a little bit more into that, if you feel safe enough to do? Could you speak a little bit more into that?
So like, I had a very lucrative financially corporate job, but at the same time, I had a 2-hour daily commute in the car through traffic, rush hour, worked, 40, 50-hour weeks at least, said yes to everything at work, anything outside. So although yes, I was successful on paper, it was not what I thought was successful, but I kept doing it because I didn't know any better. And it was a lesson that I think is why my cancer kept coming back until I stopped repeating the pattern, right? Like I was in treatment, still went back to work. 2 hours commuting, 8-hour plus days, going through treatment, still working. And then feeling so much guilt when I had to leave to go to appointments. It was tearing my soul apart. And I think that's why it kept coming back, because it was like, you're not going to learn this until you learn this.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, diseases keep presenting themselves, and our body keeps presenting these symptoms to wake us up, so we don't keep going down the same path. And yes, you developed cancer, which is a very high-end lesson, but so you don't keep going. So it's fantastic that you actually eventually learned the lesson.
So am I. I'm very grateful, Rita.
I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure you did. For people who maybe are listening that do have cancer, can you explain, like in hindsight, what were some of the symptoms that felt confusing at the time that now makes so much sense? What are some of the things that you were feeling? And just like you were saying, you were people pleasing, you were working, you felt almost shame to leave your work, to put you first, to prioritize your health and what you were going through. And so you may not have, recognized all those very, very early symptoms, those really early symptoms that something's happening, but you think, oh, it could be something else. You brush them off. Can you speak a little bit more to that of, now you know that what they were and they make so much sense, but in the beginning they didn't. What were they?
Yeah, I think the ones you mentioned were clearly present and evident. I think there was a lot of internal, I can't even describe this. The only way I can is like internal agitation always. Like the best example I can give is like the simplest thing of like I wanted to go work out on the weekend because it was like, that I had more time, I could actually do it. And the minute my husband be like, "No, let's go to brunch," I'd be like, "Okay." But internally, I was like frustrated and fuming. Like, I never get to do what I want to do. Right? Like, I can't explain it other than like this internal, like, you just feel agitated inside and you don't know why. And you're just like, okay, well, I'm going to do this. It'll be fine. You're going to have fun. And I'm not saying it wasn't fun, but like, it wasn't truly what I wanted to do. And I think that was one that really still is hard to name and hard to understand even for myself of like that's a weird way to show up where you're just internally agitated all the time. Like you're saying yes to all these things, but there's such a big piece of you that wants to say no.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that caused that tension, the tension of not being true and authentic to yourself and to your own voice and to your own needs, and the power of saying no. For people, for people pleasers, that power of saying no isn't an easy place to arrive at. I know for myself it wasn't. And when you actually start putting in those boundaries, I suppose it's you lacked boundaries, and everyone else was more important than you.
Yes, because that's how I was what I was taught. I'm not important, but everyone else is, right? And I didn't have boundaries, and I didn't know you could say no to work things. Like legitimately, I did not know.
Well, until you actually, and unless you do actually have those boundaries and you didn't experience the type of trauma that you did, it would come natural to other people. Like I know so many friends and so many family members, etc. It just comes natural to go, no, I'm not going to do that. Or no, that doesn't feel good. No, that doesn't sit right with me. I'm was like you. I couldn't say those words. Mine was always whatever you want. Oh, if that's right for you. Oh, or not engaging in conflict, not wanting to offend, not speaking up for yourself. Were they all the things that you were experiencing? Were you still experiencing that whilst you were going through treatment? Or did you have more of an aha moment when you got sick?
No, while I was in the midst of the majority of my treatments, there's this weird thing that happens to a lot of women. I'm not an anomaly, but you want to be the good patient. You want to be the best patient, quote unquote. And I say that because you want to follow and do everything they say to a T because you're so afraid that if you don't, you're not going to survive. And so it's kind of the same, but it's not, because you think your life literally depends on it. And so psychologically, it's a little different because of the trauma, but it's still basically the same thing. And so I didn't feel like I had autonomy over my body or my time, my persons, my things. And so it just, I think, it kept exacerbating what I was feeling on the inside. I just didn't have the language or the understanding of, like, how do I stop it and what am I supposed to do with it?
Really going through that sort of treatment is the ultimate of what you had been experiencing, if I can say, where you had to totally relinquish control and hand that control over to someone else who was saving your life.
Right.
So that was
100%.
like a higher order of what the pattern that had been playing out. If you don't mind, if it's okay, can you speak a little t for our listeners? Can you speak a little to the type of treatment and what you went through to be in remission?
Yeah, so I did
And the stroke as well. What happened there? What happened?
So 4 months into my treatment, one of the drugs called pegasparaginase, which is specifically given to ALL patients. I didn't know this at the time. I didn't find this out until about a year ago when I read the full breakdown of my treatment plan. I had cancer in my brain and they never said anything, or if they said it, I don't recall it at all. And I asked my husband about it, and he goes, "No, I don't remember that. I would remember something like that." So I think they just didn't say it out loud, but it's written on my report as, like, little, like, I forget what the language is, but it says, like, in the brain. And I was like, "What?" So what it is they give you intrathecal chemo, and so they take out fluid in between your spine and then put the chemotherapy in your spine to go directly to your brain. And 4 months into treatment, after one of those treatments, I had a CF leak, which is where the fluid is imbalanced, and you basically it's like an extreme version of vertigo. So I couldn't lift my head up. I kept, like, wanting to, like, throw up or fall over. Well, that combination, and then I wasn't drinking or eating for, like, a couple of days straight, basically exacerbated everything into a stroke.
On top of
And
everything.
so I lost function in my left side. I had to relearn how to walk, talk, eat, and all still going through treatment because I wasn't in remission. Yeah, talk about a humbling experience. I've never experienced something like that, and I knew at some point, like, we all get to that point where we need help, but I definitely didn't think it was going to be at 31.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you went for three rounds. So you had treatment for the leukemia, and in that first round of treatment, you end up having the stroke.
Yeah.
And so then you would have stayed in hospital longer for the rehabilitation, I assume.
Yeah, so I went back into the hospital for 3 weeks. And that was just initially to address the stroke and get function back so I can go back home. So I still went to outpatient rehab for 8 weeks, 5 days a week, 3 hours every single day, and still went and got chemo in the meantime. And then I thought it was a really bright idea to go back to work while I was still not in treat not in remission, still undergoing treatment, because I wanted to be the good, I don't know, the good employee that didn't miss anything, right? Like, I hadn't missed a day of work in 10 years. Like, now I was missing months. And that guilt and that pressure and that feeling like a burden to everyone really was taking mentally a toll. And so I went back to work, and then I finished my treatment protocol. 7 weeks later, I relapsed the first time. My body was no longer responding to chemotherapy. We tried an immunotherapy that basically sent me into a cytokine release storm. It's where your body attacks itself from the inside out, tries to kill you. I know, right? Right? It's like ridiculous at this point. So they were like, okay, we have a clinical trial going on that you can go on, and that's it. And I'm like, how do we get here so fast, right? How do we get to a clinical trial all of a sudden?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, your body's not responding to chemotherapy, and this is the only next course of action available. And we're like, okay. So I do all the testing that is involved in a clinical trial, and they test you for everything. So it takes forever, because they need baselines for it. And a week before I was supposed to go on it, the trial got shut down.
Oh my.
I was like, of course, you give me hope and then you take it away. So then my husband and I at the time looked at the team and we're like, what are our options? They're like, well, we don't really have anything yet. We're like, okay. They're like, there's another clinical trial at a neighboring hospital, but they're like, the trial is full. There's a wait list. Even if we get you on the wait list, it doesn't guarantee you qualify for the trial. And I was like, well, how long is that going to take? Because it doesn't sound like I have a lot of time. So they're like, well, we'll put you on the list. We'll get you on the list and we'll figure it out. And I was like, it's not a great plan. But what options do you have? And I'm like, maybe we need to start searching like globally and all these things. And the Leukemia and Lymphoma Doctors Conference had just ended, and one of my doctors at no the hospital that I went to came back and was like, do you want to try this? Gave my husband and I two pages of research, 114 participants. 11 people had the disease that I had specifically. The outcomes were not great. And this immunotherapy was not for my cancer. It was specifically for a different cancer. And they're like, do you want to try it? I was like, it doesn't sound like I have like another option. I'm like, so my husband and I debate, and I look over at him and I go, after like a couple of days, I go, even if this doesn't help me, it might actually really help someone else.
What an amazing thought to have whilst you're going through that.
Yeah, because I was like,
How
if
many
I'm gonna
people
die,
would
I'm
think
not.
like that?
I would hope a lot, because all I was thinking was, if I die, it's not going to be for nothing.
That's powerful. That
It's
is
going
very.
to at least help somebody else.
So you went, you did the trial?
Yeah, so no, I didn't do the trial. So this experimental immunotherapy, they sent me home from the hospital, wrote a letter of compassion to the FDA and the drug manufacturer just to get access to it. And we waited. So 2 months later, they finally said, yes, you can have the drug. And I went through four rounds of it. It got me into remission to go to a stem cell transplant. My brother is my donor. I did a stem cell transplant. And then when I thought I was getting better and I was like, oh, I'm just building back stamina and strength and all these things. Meanwhile, they put you through more chemo and 10 rounds of total body radiation for me for my stem cell transplant. So you're like completely depleted of everything. I'm trying to physically recover. And 6 months later, they're like, your cancer's back. And I was like, what?
That is just unbelievable.
They caught it so early. I was not feeling anything, although I wasn't feeling
When you say
good.
caught it early, was that the third time you're saying that they caught it early
Yeah.
the third time? So I had just started coming back.
Yep.
And is that because you went in for a routine test, like the after test?
Yeah, so at that point, because of the stem cell transplant and everything that I had undergone, I was going back to the hospital still once a week for an appointment with my oncology team. So I was getting blood work every week, and if I needed platelets and blood, they'd give me those too. So I was going back routinely, and it was at one of the routine blood work appointments that they were like, it's back. And my immediate reaction was like, I looked at my husband and I go, I can't do this. I don't have it in me anymore. I am not. I go, I'm done. I was not prepared. I don't know how long I cried. My face was down, and he goes, whatever you decide is what we're gonna do. And I just was like, I can't. I'm not physically, mentally, I'm not, this is not where my head was at, right? My head was already focused on getting my life back. And I was like, I can't keep fighting this disease for the rest of my life. I'm like, this isn't a life. And the first thought that popped in back into my head as I'm like thinking this in my head is, your dad would be so disappointed in you.
Oh.
I know. And I was like, oh, of course he comes in. Because my dad, like, he showed up every single day, even if it were 5 minutes, to make sure I was okay every single day.
Beautiful.
And I was like, oh, of course you're gonna make me do this again. Now, like, not like make me, but like, that's who comes into my head. And I remember even begrudgingly thinking, like, fine. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I was like, fine. And that's when I made my deal with the universe. I was like, I'm gonna do this one more time. That's it. We are done. So either you're gonna kill me or you're gonna let me live, but I am not doing this forever. And I go, and this isn't for me. I don't care anymore. I've made my peace. I go, this is for everyone that got me here. Everyone that's was here every step of the way. And I picked my head back up. I looked at my husband and I go, okay, I got one more. That's it. We're done. He goes, okay.
The strength. I'm lost for words, I'll be honest. The emotion is beautiful. The strength is amazing to be able to keep going. And if it's not too hard for you, that's something I was going to ask, is in those moments in hospital, how you must have connected mind to heart. How did you find the strength to keep going and to keep making these decisions? It must have been. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, a lot of people just give up. They give up on themselves. But I mean, understandable, you'd be exhausted after three times. That would be I can't even imagine what that would be like to go through. You're incredible. Prior to your third time, you've done your first round, then it comes back and you're back in hospital and you're doing your second round. Where did that strength come from in you? From being a people pleaser to now, like a superwoman almost. Where did you find that strength to encourage some of the listeners who just want who give up? I've spoken to some people that think I just wouldn't do it.
First and foremost, I want to say you have no idea what lengths you will go to when your back's up against a wall. You have no idea what you can do when you feel like you have no other option. And this is something that I tapped into. I think I learned even from when I was in high school and I couldn't control this person telling me I'm a horrible person and I'm all these things that I know I'm not. That was anger, but this was different. Like, each time I think there was like this deep level of like, what can you do is what I kept asking myself, because you don't know the outcome, right? Like, but what can you do? I focused on getting up, showering, all the little daily things that like might sound kind of boring, but they kept me grounded and tied to this earth and not going in a million directions one way or the other. And it was always like, what can you do? Well, when I had my stroke, I was like, okay, to get out of the hospital, you need to learn how to tie your shoe, because that means you can bend down. That means you can balance. That means you could put on a sock. That means you could put on a shoe. Like, just learn how to tie your shoe. That means your digits are working, right? Like, so I focused on so much of what I could do. And And I didn't focus on what was not in my control.
That's amazing.
And I just doubled down on, like, okay, I can't control if it comes back or not, but I can control if I'm physically, mentally, and emotionally strong enough to keep fighting. Because that third time when they told me and I wanted to give up, I was like, I'm not going to put myself in that position ever again to mentally want to give up or physically not feel like I can do this. So that was like, from that point on, I was like, you are going to get your body strong. Your mind's going to be in a different place. And emotionally, you're going to take care of everything because we are not doing this again. And I made that promise to myself. I made promises to myself along the way that when you get done, these are the things you're going to do. And I've kept those promises.
That's fantastic. I love the way they were future focused. So being,
Always.
being future focused means that you had a plan. It means you were going to keep working towards something. They weren't in the present. They weren't like, oh, I can't. I'm not. I'm here now. I love the way everything was. I am. That is, you're saying I'm surviving this, and I'm going to move forward, and I'm going to back myself. I love your story so much because it's about, I talk about on this podcast, on my website, everything like that is about people backing themselves. You have to have that internal courage to back yourself when something like this happens, because if you don't, who's going to?
Right.
If you're not going to look after yourself and stand up for yourself, just like the people pleaser didn't. Well, then who is going to do it for you?
Right.
Yeah. And like, that's what I love about you is that you've done it. You backed yourself and look where you are. One of the things that I find really kind of frustrating about the healthcare system, and I don't blame the healthcare system here because it's a broader system here. It's a broader problem. It's not doctor focused. I know when I've had things happen to me, I've asked specialists, and this is what I'm curious about knowing with you. You have your treatment, like you went in for cancer, you had your treatment, you went into remission third time. So third time you're now here. But what I find difficult is the ending of the treatment to then starting your new life, or the ending of the treatment to then knowing what to do. That your body's different. Like, I had half a thyroid removed. My body's never been the same. And when I asked the specialist, oh, what about if I have symptoms? He goes, you don't speak to me about that. And so it's this part of being left on your own. It's being left not knowing what to do. When you finish your treatment, was there anything for you, or were you left just to navigate that void between, okay, your treatment's finished, we've saved your life, and now off you go?
Yeah.
How did you navigate that space?
So once I got back into remission after the immunotherapy, I thought we were going to do another stem cell transplant, right? Like I thought that was the goal. And they were like, no, we're just going to wait. And I'm like, okay, I don't like this plan. This isn't a great plan. And just wait and see if it comes back. Like, this is not, are you just waiting for me to die again? Like, what's happening? And then about 6 months into waiting, I finally worked up the courage and was like, do you think I can go live life again? And my medical team, they're great. They looked at me and they're like, yeah, why not? And I was like, I don't know, because you guys like haven't really given me clear direction on if it's coming back or not or any insight into that. And they're like, yeah, because we don't know. And I was like, oh, okay, great. So well, how do I do that? Like, how do I get my life back? And they're like, we don't know. And I was like, they literally said, we don't know. And I was like, that's not helpful. And I was already in therapy at that time, but like that exacerbated how I felt on the inside was like disappointment from our system failing us. And that internal anger
Yeah.
that I felt I was it pissed me off, quite frankly. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear or not,
No,
but
that's
it did, right? Like that same fuel got lit in me again that was there in high school, and I was like, this is wrong. This is so wrong. And so as a byproduct of what I did for myself, like I had to figure out what to do, right? Like I was in therapy. It wasn't enough. I knew how to physically recover and it still wasn't enough. I was like, okay, well, what else? Like I just kept searching for answers to fix myself. And then the more I shared with about it openly and publicly about not only what I was doing, but the struggle of figuring it out, the more I was like, oh, I'm not alone. 'Cause I thought I was like the only one that felt that way. Like the disappointment between being done with treatment and then figure it out. I thought everyone else was getting this level of care. I wasn't somehow. I don't know why I thought that. And I was wrong. It's everyone and it's globally. It's not just where you're at or where I'm at. It's everywhere. The system is letting us down.
there is such a void between the two where people are left confused. That is a really that's the really hard space. That and it's a big void that I just don't think's been addressed. And that will lead me to ask you, is that why you started, is that why you developed the business that you're in? Is that why you became a yoga teacher, a Reiki? To start, was it first to heal yourself and then you actually recognized where people were struggling after, you know, having, well, you deal with people with cancer, so after the treatment, and then they're going, well, I'm not the same. And maybe some people can't do the same things or they don't know emotionally how to move forward, you know, because it's quite traumatic. It's a tra I think people underestimate that when you go through a major health concern, how traumatic that actually is and the effect. And you know, again, trauma equals stress. You don't want to be repeating the same patterns, but unless you have the tools and maybe the roadmap of how to move forward, it's easy to be stuck.
Yeah. And selfishly, yes, I did do a lot of these to help myself, right? Like especially the ones in the beginning. Now I'm like, oh, this would be really helpful to know for myself, yes, but more so for like my clients. I'm a lifelong learner, so I'll never stop picking up certificates and education in some form or fashion. But yeah, I selfishly was trying to fix myself and heal myself and figure out the missing pieces of how to navigate life again. And as a byproduct, I the more I was talking about it openly, more women were like, how did you do it? But how did you do it? What did you do? Like they wanted more specificity. And I was like, oh, like I can maybe actually help people. And so I started with just like, okay, this is how you can physically recover, because in my mind that to me was by far the easiest thing to do.
Yes.
And then the emotional part, but the so I started just doing with physical recovery, and then I realized I was running into roadblocks, right? Where people were just logically going, yes, I know I need to do all these things and I could do those, but then they would start breaking down, right? Like something would get in their way and they would stop, or they wouldn't want to do it to begin with. Like they had no motivation, even though we have all the motivation in the world. And that's when I was like, it's the mental and emotional components that I need to keep add into it. And so I feel like after that first like initial like 6 months, I figured out like it's a whole body approach and it's got to be. We're a whole person. Like we're not just the food we eat, we're not just the exercise we do. We are a mind, a body, and a soul.
Absolutely, absolutely. And obviously, as I was doing a bit of research around your experience, I noticed you talk a little bit about it's not so much the trauma that's the issue. It's you wrote how we internalize that trauma. That's what I find sort of fascinating. I think That's what people need to hear. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, so like it's with any trauma, big T trauma, little T traumas, right? It's how we internalize it. And the best example that I can give to that is like, especially when it comes to like little T trauma. Like little T trauma is like, you know, the boy down the street makes fun of you and says you have a big forehead. But from that moment on, you always have bangs because you internalize that conversation to go, I have a big forehead. I got to cover it up because my forehead's so big. I don't want anyone to see it because it's that big, right? Like it's little tiny things that add up to big belief systems in ourselves, right? Like and it's how we internalize that experience. You know, my coping mechanisms weren't, they got me through treatment. They were definitely not working afterward. So I all those coping mechanisms that I learned, though, helped me keep my head down and focused on getting better, but they didn't help me when I was better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And obviously, what happened to you and the trauma of having this cancer, that catapulted you into your own personal growth and developing. I believe you've got a course that you've developed that helps women. Is it women specific?
It can be for men, but I find I work with only women 99.9% of the time. I'll get a man every now and again, but it's really about women are more keen to open up and talk about the mental and emotional effects versus men are a little bit more shut down when it comes to that, which is
Yes.
unfortunate because I think they probably need it more than we do.
Yes. Just
Just a little bit.
a little bit. They're the
A little
worst.
bit.
And not meaning to generalize, but they are the worst when it comes to going to the doctor, to having anything. I mean, my husband had a terrible health scare at the beginning of last year, and it took me a week just to get him to the doctor
Oh my
because
gosh.
I'm okay. No, it was every reason under the sun. So we digress on that. But can you speak a little into what is this program? And if someone wants to come in and speak to you about the program, what does it do for them?
So it's a 13-week survivorship program. We address the mind, the body, and the emotional and mental effects that this has on you in your life. They can expect to learn how to process their emotions. They will find a new path forward. They will learn how to build back their confidence up, not only in themselves, but their bodies. We do a lot of work that's around, because there's so much disassociation from your body about learning how to be with your body again and how to love it. Because women have a really, I wouldn't say, I'd say unhealthy relationship with their body to begin with, and cancer can exacerbate a lot of that. And so there's that. We address the fear and the anxiety. Like, how do you, what are natural holistic things that you can do every single day that will help that fear and that anxiety start to go away? You know, and there's also nutrition, and there's always there's practical things inside of there as well. How do you plan for a future? You know, what is it that you even want to do? There's the whole module on purpose and meaning for you, you know, and figuring out what it is you want to do.
That it sounds brilliant and it sounds very comprehensive and holistic, and it also seems like you've tapped into what we spoke about previously about that void between leaving hospital or the operation or whatever it is that you've had, and then moving forward and you're feeling confused, like where do I go, what do I do, or how do I feel about myself again? How do I recognize myself? Like sometimes you can come out feeling a bit fractured towards your own body or
Yeah.
angry at yourself that this has happened, to some people go, this, I allowed this to happen to me, etc. So
Right.
yeah, so this program sounds like it definitely helps people emotionally, physically, on all levels, which is beautiful. To end, I would like to, if you could possibly tell our listeners, what were some of the most helpful things that you did or what people did for you post your cancer treatment? And maybe some of the most,
Afterward,
what are some of the things that you personally did that you found the most helpful in the immediate?
I would say, do not get stuck. And what do I mean by that? Like, we have the ability to go, well, I'm done. I need to just rest and, let life happen for a while, and then I'll pick myself back up. That when you let yourself down, like, talk about a hill, on the way down from the hill, you can get stuck in that chasm, and it's hard to start walking back up the next hill, right? The hill is life, right? Well, we have to get back into it, and it's about forging a new path. And I think taking action before you quote unquote think you're ready is when you need to take action, because if you wait too long, you're not going to. And you're just going to get stuck. I've worked with women who are 15 years out from surviving, and they're like, I wish I had this 15 years ago. Because mentally and emotionally, they were stuck in that chasm.
So they were stuck in the past. They were still stuck post-treatment and they hadn't moved forward.
Right. But they were white knuckling through life because they were like, well, I've got kids and I've got things and I've got all these things. It's like, no, do you realize what you just went through is one of the most traumatic events you can go through in your life? Why are you just brushing it off like nothing happened?
And so you help the women acknowledge and give respect to the process that they've been through, and allowing them to, because it wasn't that one of the situations for you in the beginning. You were given, the signs were there, but you weren't aware or awake enough to realize. And so you can come out and you've been given this huge life lesson. And then we go back into our old patterns. And that's what
Right.
I'm assuming that your course helps people reset that.
Exactly. Like, we have the ability to learn the lesson or not. And it's, there's a beautiful quote, what we don't repair, we repeat.
I love that. That is
And
so.
it's not mine. I wish I came up with it. It's brilliant.
It's one of those, darn it.
I know.
Casey, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Honestly, I feel so honored that you felt safe enough to share your story. It's emotionally, it's really moved me a lot. I've been very moved by your story, by your strength, and by all your wisdom that you've been able to share on this session to help other people going through what you've gone through. It doesn't have to be exactly your cancer. It doesn't have to be cancer. It can be anything, but take the wisdom and the strength that you've developed and, move forward with your life. And hopefully, I encourage everyone to check the show notes, because to be able to get in contact with Casey, everything will be there. And if anyone's gone through a similar journey, please book in, do yourself the favor. We need to move forward. We need to change. Things change when we change. It has been such a pleasure. Thank you, Casey. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I would love to know, what was the biggest insight or aha moment you got from this interview, so you can now speak up, take action, and make informed decisions for your health. And if you like this episode, get instant access to your free ebook, Alternative Wisdom, Taking Back Control of Your Health at life-onus.com.